You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The U.S. Senate is expected to confirm former Goldman Sachs banker Steven Mnuchin as Secretary of the Treasury today, and some fear that might lead to a regulatory rollback of Dodd-Frank. New Yorker staff writer Sheila Kolhatkar's investigation of Stephen A. Cohn's dubious financial activities and the power a few men have over the U.S. economy suggests that we need to maintain a strong check on Wall Street. Her book, Black Edge, Inside Information, Dirty Money, and the Quest to Bring Down the Most Wanted Man on Wall Street, is published by Random House. I'm very pleased it has brought Sheila Kolhatkar to our show today. Welcome and congratulations on the great reviews this book has been receiving. You've been looking into insider trading and corruption on Wall Street for years. How concerned are you that Dodd-Frank may be rolled back? Some people feel it's an imperfect law.
Well, of course, I would agree it's not perfect. But the question when you propose rolling back something like Dodd-Frank is, what are you going to replace it with? And we're in this very interesting situation where we have President Trump, who campaigned quite aggressively, I would say, on an anti-Wall Street message. He was telling Americans that he was going to fight for middle-class jobs. The system was rigged. He picked on Hillary Clinton over her Goldman Sachs speeches. And what we've seen since he's started to choose his cabinet and his advisors is he's just brought in one wealthy Wall Street financier after another. I mean, there's Mr. Mnuchin.
Have you spoken to Mnuchin?
I have not personally spoken with him. I think he's an interesting figure. He's a very smart, accomplished guy. But I just think when you look on a whole at all of these wealthy Wall Street men President Trump has surrounded himself with, you have to wonder what their priorities are going to be and whose interests are going to be top of mind for them.
And Goldman Sachs in particular, he castigated Hillary Clinton for her ties to Goldman Sachs. Is Goldman Sachs just the bad guy of the moment, or is there a reason why Goldman Sachs rather than any other company?
Well, people have been getting upset about Goldman Sachs' influence on the government and on policymaking for a really long time. Now, in the financial world, Goldman is considered the sort of top, most prestigious investment bank. It attracts the best and brightest college graduates, young people from all over the world. In fact, every year they release numbers, you know, in terms of showing how many people have applied for jobs there and internships and how many they've accepted. And I think in some years it's harder to get a job there than it is to get into Harvard, for example. So this is a place where people are flocking. And these are young people who could be doing something else with their lives. You know, these are accomplished graduates of MIT, of math programs, science programs. They could be going into research. They could be joining startups. Many of them are flooding to Goldman Sachs. And there's a tradition there of making people extremely wealthy, but also instilling in them this idea that they should go into public service later in their careers. So many do.
Is Black Edge, the term you've used as the title of your book, commonly used in the financial world?
It isn't widespread. I found that it was unique to the story that I was writing about in the book, but it refers to something that is a broader phenomenon. And it's important to remember that if you're working on Wall Street as a trader and you're trying to make money every day in the stock market, you live and die by information. And hedge funds in particular make money, you know, based on how good their information is. So they're all out there competing with one another for the best information so they can make the most money.
And you begin with a wiretap conversation between a woman and Raj Rajaratnam, the 50-year-old co-founder of the Galleon Group. Who was listening in?
Well, an ambitious, hardworking FBI agent who is one of the key characters in my book. His name is BJ Kang. And he became sort of the lead investigator in this big crackdown on insider trading at hedge funds that I document in my story. And much of the story of Black Edge grew out of this Rajaratnam case, which got a lot of attention at the time. Rajaratnam was a prominent hedge fund manager on Wall Street. He traded in tech stocks. He was very wealthy and successful. We kind of know why now. He's in jail. But he was not sort of a lion of the industry. He was not someone who was held up as sort of a role model. I would argue that that person is Steve Cohen, who is the central figure in my story. I mean, and the investigation of Cohen grew directly out of the Rajaratnam case.
Who was the woman who was speaking with Raj?
She's a very interesting character. Her name is Danielle Chiesi. She was a hedge fund trader. And the government found through these wiretaps and other investigatory methods that she was gathering up information from different sources, mostly in the technology world, and then sharing that with her friends at other hedge funds, including Mr. Rajaratnam. And she was a very attractive woman, and she seemed to be quite intentionally using her feminine charms to sort of seduce these various men and get inside information out of them.
And then she was paid for them by people like Raj?
Well, they would sort of trade tips and favors. So you help me out one day with a tip, I'm going to help you out tomorrow. They would kind of team up or agree, okay, we're going to keep this one just between us so we can make money on it. The thing with inside information is that this is generally information that others in the market don't know. And that is why it's valuable, because once everyone knows it, the stock price is going to reflect that information. So as soon as it starts to get shared widely, it becomes less useful to the traders.
And she told Raj that a company, Akmani's shares, were going to drop. He made millions of dollars on knowing that the stock was going to drop, selling short.
That's right. So selling short is basically a bet against a stock. It's the opposite of what most people do. It's you're betting that the stock is going to go down, and not everyone in the market does this. It's sort of a high-risk activity. But the traders at these hedge funds who I'm writing about do this a lot. And if you find out that a company is going to announce earnings that are going to be worse than what everyone is expecting, you can make a lot of money shorting the stock before that news comes out. And so that's what they were doing.
Now, you mentioned Special Agent BJ Kang. How much listening does he have to do before he hears a conversation like this?
Well, that's a good question. That's something they constantly have to debate and strategize over, because in this particular case, okay, they were investigating Raj. They had wiretaps up. And every day they were gathering new bits of evidence from listening to these live calls. It was one of the first time that the government had been listening in on Wall Street traders doing their jobs.
Do these guys specialize? Would BJ Kang have been somebody who knew something about Wall Street?
He was a specialist in financial crime. However, there was this very key moment that I describe in the book in the early 2000s when, the FBI's securities fraud unit had been spending a lot of time on smaller cases, on little stock frauds run out of small offices and Long Island strip malls, little things like of the sort you might see in the Wolf of Wall Street movie. And one day, BJ Kang's boss came up to him and said, "Listen, BJ, hedge funds are this huge force on Wall Street. Hedge funds were just sort of exploding into real prominence at this time." And the FBI realized that they did not know what the world was going on in these hedge funds. They were very lightly regulated. They were secretive. And so Kang's boss sort of said to him, "Can you go and figure out what's going on?" So BJ Kang had spent months trying to educate himself on hedge funds, what they were, who the big players were, how they operated. And part of that was sort of a reporting research process where he just talked to his sources and he talked to people in the industry. And increasingly, the name SAC Capital, which was Steve Cohen's hedge fund, came up. And people
those
kept,
are his initials.
Those are his
Stephen
initials.
Stephen A. Cohen.
Yes, exactly. So Cohen's fund was one of the most successful hedge funds we had ever seen, and he had become immensely wealthy running this fund. And many of Cohen's competitors on Wall Street were a little frustrated about how he was beating them every year. And some of them expressed this to BJ Kang. They said, "Well, you think this is kind of dicey. What's going on over at SAC? None of us can figure out how they're making so much money." So BJ Kang's interest was piqued, and he decided, he was going to look into it.
I'm speaking with Sheila Kolhatkar. Her book, Black Edge, Inside Information, Dirty Money, and the Quest to Bring Down the Most Wanted Man on Wall Street. Okay, well, it took a while for him to learn what hedge funds were all about. Can you give us the one or two minute version?
hedge funds originally came into being as special investments that catered to wealthy investors. And the idea behind the name hedge fund was that the person managing the fund was going to hedge their investments, which basically means if you own a bunch of airline stocks, for example, and you're betting that those airline stocks are going to go up, you might hedge your position. You might take another position shorting a company that would offset some of your losses in case you've made the wrong bet. So the idea is you have sort of offsetting positions to mitigate your losses. And, you know, many wealthy investors wanted to find ways to protect their money from just the general up and down zigzag of the stock market. So the idea was rich people could put their money in hedge funds. The hedge funds would agree, you know, only to take money from wealthy investors who could afford, in theory, to
originally
lose the money.
Individuals originally.
And in exchange for only kind of catering to this very sophisticated group of investors, regulators allowed hedge funds more leeway to take risk in the market, like borrowing money to trade on, shorting stocks. These are sort of riskier activities that regular old mutual funds like Fidelity are not supposed to be involved in. But if you're a very wealthy person, you can afford to lose your investment. So hedge funds were allowed to play a little more aggressively.
And the hedge fund takes a piece of a percentage. That's how it makes money?
Well, yes. So one of the defining attributes of a hedge fund is the very aggressive fee structure. So people talk a lot about fees and something you want to pay attention to always with your investments. Hedge funds charge the largest fees almost you can pay in investing. There's a management fee, which is usually about 2% of the assets. And the hedge fund manager is supposed to use that to pay for overhead and his offices and his research and his secretary, whatever it is. And then the hedge fund manager takes a 20 to 50% cut of the profits at the end of the year. And the idea behind that is that you're going to incentivize this individual to make money for you because he or she's going to make money for themselves at the same time. And this became a vehicle for enormous wealth generation.
But it also sounds like they're conducive to illegal trading.
Well, of course, it depends on who you ask. But so there is this sort of moment I describe in the book where there's an employee of Steve Cohen's fund, SAC, and he's trying to teach the young traders who work for him what the difference is between different kinds of information because he wants them to stay out of trouble. And he says to them, okay, there are three types of information. There's white edge, gray edge, and black edge. White edge is widely available, publicly available information that anyone can get. It's kind of useless because everyone knows it. There's gray edge, which is really the area where they operate most of the time. And that's information where you're not really sure. I mean, perhaps you call up a company and you speak with an executive and they give you some hints about what's going to happen in the future. And you kind of go back to your desk and you say, well, is that material non-public information? Is that inside information I'm not supposed to trade on? Or can I trade on that? And, you know, sometimes you might have to talk with your legal counsel at your hedge fund to find out. And then there's black edge, which is clearly confidential information that is not supposed to be publicly disclosed. And often people working at hedge funds will come across that information.
So they speak to people in a wide range of professions, doctors, engineers, scientists, lawyers, Walmart shoppers, Silicon Valley employees, others. Do they pay for this information?
Well, hedge funds overall, many of them have been enormously successful. So they have tremendous resources available to them. And there's a lot of competition in the hedge fund world. And as I mentioned earlier, as with Goldman Sachs, you have the best and the brightest young people out of top colleges flocking to these hedge funds because you can just get so rich working there. So you have all of these people, and this is something that BJ Kang had observed at one point during his investigation, all of these geniuses competing to the death to kind of make the best returns. What is going to set them apart? What can they do that the other hedge funds are not doing? And the FBI certainly felt that some of that was cheating. But, you know, there are many legal things that they can do as well. I mean, for example, many hedge funds pay to gain access to satellite images of Walmart parking lots. So over the course of months or years, by studying pictures from the air of the parking lot of all the Walmarts in America, you could piece together with a fancy, powerful computer, piece together a picture of how Walmart is doing. Now,
would just guess they're doing well.
It sounds crazy, but basically any possible advantage they could find, they're going to find it. And money is almost no object for many of them. And just to name one more example, I mean, many of these funds are paying to have their own fiber optic cable laid so that their trades can be executed microseconds faster. I mean, that's literally what this comes down to. Microseconds, pennies, fractions of pennies. Over time, this adds up to a profit.
My guest is Sheila Kolhatkar, who's a former hedge fund analyst and now a staff writer at The New Yorker, where she covers Wall Street, Silicon Valley, politics, among other things. She's also written for Bloomberg, Business Week, New York Magazine, The Atlantic, The New York Times, and other publications. And she has a book called Black Edge, Inside Information, Dirty Money, and the Quest to Bring Down the Most Wanted Man on Wall Street. It is published by Random House. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Sheila Kolhatkar. Her book, Black Edge, Inside Information, Dirty Money, and the Quest to Bring Down the Most Wanted Man on Wall Street, is published by Random House. How much did these FBI agents earn in contrast to these the people we're talking about? For example, you describe Raj and Stephen Cohn's lifestyles. For one birthday, didn't Raj fly 70 friends to Kenya?
Oh, I would say that's probably almost standard behavior in the top of the hedge fund industry.
Why Kenya? Did they go on a safari?
Yeah, to look at some nice animals, some wild animals. But no, that's what's incredible about this hedge fund world. I don't think people even realize it. It has minted a new generation of enormously wealthy people. I mean, if you fly over Greenwich, Connecticut, which most people don't do, there are enormous palatial mansions there that look like Versailles, and that's where these people have parked themselves. And you know, Steve Cohen again was a real symbol of this lifestyle. He made such an incredible amount of money just trading at his hedge fund. And there's a scene I describe in the book which is sort of telling. It was in 1998. His fund had been open only a handful of years, and Mr. Cohen decided he wanted to buy a new house. They were going to kind of upgrade their house. They made an offer on a house, very large mansion in Greenwich, you know, at the end of a long, long driveway. You can't really see it from the road. And found out that someone else, another Wall Street executive, had already made an offer on the house. So Steve Cohen spoke with him over the phone and said, why don't we flip a coin for it? And the other guy was completely horrified by this, you know, sort of scandalized him. He thought his wife would be really angry if he flipped a coin for their house. So he refused, and they had this little bidding war. And ultimately, Steve Cohen ended up buying the house for over $14 million in cash. I'll write you a check. Here you go. And that was a real moment when you could see, okay, something has changed. These people have become, this new kind of robber baron type of figure. They have so much money that it's almost of no object. And they become an incredible force in politics as well. Many hedge fund managers are some of the biggest political donors. So I do think it's important for people to just be aware of this.
Now, in investigating these illegal activities, they had to find out, they had to talk to other people. For example, Special Agent Kang, after he recorded Raj using insider information, reached out to a man named Ali Farr, who had worked for Raj. And then he went to see another former Galleon employee, Richard Chu Bing Lee. Now, this is a small world. If these guys cooperate, aren't they going to hurt themselves in the future?
Well, at one point, the FBI, after they decided to train their attention on the hedge fund industry, which they felt they'd been neglecting for a while, they decided to apply some of the techniques they had used in mafia cases to Wall Street. So they were going to use wiretaps. They were going to try to use informants and cooperators. And again, this was a fairly new thing in the white-collar world. So their technique was quite simple. They would try and flip somebody, get that person to cooperate with them. They would then ask that person to make a consensually recorded phone call of their friend, often giving them inside information. Then they would have a recording of that friend, and they could go to the friend and approach him on his front lawn or walk up to him in the gym and say, hey, buddy, tap him on the shoulder. we have this recording. You better work with us or you're going to go to jail. And they did this over and over. And then they get another wiretap and then they'd flip someone and they get another wiretap. And they burrowed their way up the chain into many of these funds. And it ultimately led to dozens of arrests.
But also led to an atmosphere of paranoia about who might be wearing a wire. Didn't it lead bankers to begin to use codes on the phone?
Well, sure. Eventually, Wall Street is very gossipy. And as I mentioned earlier, it is completely driven on information. And people started to talk. There were people who suspected that someone calling them up, their former friend or colleague, was cooperating. And there were others who reported seeing FBI agents in certain funds offices. So, yeah, word started to get around and people started to be careful.
A listener called in to ask, do these companies have their own counsels to protect them against lawsuits?
I'm assuming that person is referring to the hedge funds themselves.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, any good hedge fund, solid professional hedge fund, yes, has in-house counsel. And the role of that person is to train everyone on the staff at how to avoid getting into trouble. And when someone ends up in a situation that, you know, may get them into legal jeopardy, the counsel is there to give them advice. And, you know, and they all also these hedge funds end up paying for a lot of lawyers for their traders, too.
The story of the investigation into Rajan Stephen A. Cohen and SAC Capital Advisors takes place over 10 years, and there are several smaller investigations. But one thing is clear, these investigations require the dedication of these FBI agents and a willingness to pursue these wealthy and powerful people. Are you concerned that these types of investigations will be affected and are affected by the political environment at any given time in Washington?
Well, of course, they're always affected by that. And I think it's worth noting that this little flurry of criminal activity in the hedge fund world came really, you know, burst into view in 2008, 9, 10, 11, and, you know, up through the period covered in my book. That was also the same period when we saw the mortgage fraud crisis blow up the economy. And I don't think it's an accident that both of those things came at the end of a period of real deregulatory fervor in Washington. I mean, during many of those years leading up to those crises, there was a chairman at the SEC, which is responsible for policing the financial markets. The chairman of the SEC, who was appointed by George Bush, had stated plainly that he did not believe in regulation. He felt that financial markets could regulate themselves. And we have seen over and over and over that they actually cannot regulate themselves. They need smart regulation in order to function fairly and openly.
Would Bernie Madoff have been caught earlier with tighter regulation?
It's possible. I know that the fact that the Madoff scandal went on for so long is a source of great shame to the people at the SEC. But again, a lot of his crimes also occurred during a period where the SEC was being openly discouraged from pursuing aggressive cases. So a lot of what happens in terms of prosecuting financial crime trickles down from the top. And if you have someone in charge who doesn't believe in regulation, who believes that Wall Street should be left to its own devices, who wants to tear up Dodd-Frank and not replace it with anything, at least that we've seen, that's a cause for concern for everyone.
My guest is Sheila Kolhatkar. Her book, Black Edge, is published by Random House. This is WMIC, WMIC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Stephen Cohen went to Wharton, but you get the feeling that he still felt like he had something to prove. And his first job was with Gruntel. Wasn't Gruntel a company that was under a serious cloud in its own right?
Eventually, yes. I mean, I do love Stephen Cohen's personal story. He was a self-made man. He grew up in a very middle-class family in Great Neck, Long Island. Great Neck was an affluent town, and his family was very middle-class. So I have the sense that he felt, you know, he felt a little frustrated. He wanted more than he had. He was very interested in making money from an early age. He went to Wharton. And yes, his first job out of Wharton was at Gruntel, which was a small, scrappy little brokerage firm. It did not have a great reputation, but really that came out later over time. And the sense was that there wasn't a whole lot of oversight at Gruntel in terms of what people were doing. And this was in the 80s when Wall Street was a real freewheeling place. There were a lot of rumors coursing through the market. This was the era of Michael Milken and Ivan Boesky. Those are two famous insider trading cases.
Both of whom went to prison.
I believe Milken did. Boesky, yeah.
Maybe not.
He ended up cooperating with the government, but he certainly got into a lot of trouble. And those were very famous headline-dominating cases at the time. Rudy Giuliani was the U.S. attorney in Manhattan who prosecuted those guys. And it was during that era, though, that Cohen learned the trade. And he
was investigated by the SEC in 1987. What were the charges?
He was. Well, there were no charges in that case, but he was investigated. And it's, again, important to remember the environment. It was the 80s. It was the Reagan, rah-rah, money period. There was a boom in mergers and leveraged buyouts. Basically, there were kind of corporate raiders like Carl Icahn, who is now an advisor to President Trump, of course, borrowing money and taking over companies and these hostile takeovers. So every day there were just rumors in the stock market about these different mergers and takeovers. And a lot of people, including people like Gruntal, got caught up in trading on these rumors. And the SEC did investigate many suspected insider trading rings. And in Cohen's case, it did not lead to any charges. He declined to testify. He was brought in to testify before the SEC. He took the fifth, which meant he exercised his right against self-incrimination. He didn't answer any questions, and the whole thing just sort of petered out. And perhaps the SEC had bigger fish to fry because, of course, a few years later, we saw the Milken Boesky cases, but they had their hands full during that time.
And then Cohen took his people and started his own firm. And very quickly, you say that within 3 years, SEC had quadrupled in size to almost $100 million. Do we know if he was making these returns based on inside information?
Well, that has never been alleged. I mean, people will perhaps suspect that. But I guess my impression of him is that he was a very, very talented trader. I mean, the sort of people on Wall Street say about him, he's a once-in-a-generation talent. And I think that is very true. From the moment he sat down in front of a trading station and started looking at the market and trying to make money, he was very good at it. And, to whatever extent there was insider trading going on at his firm, I think he himself had an incredible skill and would have been an enormous success even if none of that had happened.
Part of the story you tell here is one of those truth is stranger than fiction things, is about his personal life, his marriage, the divorce, and then the second marriage. And they all play a role in this, even though we're talking about financial matters.
Well, doesn't one spouse always have a huge impact on what you do? I mean, he had a fairly unfortunate divorce from his first wife just before he started his hedge fund. And that continued to kind of follow him around for years because they were involved in a fairly ugly litigation that got a lot of attention. She alleged in court documents that he had misled her about his assets and all sorts of other stuff. And she, in filing a case against him later, helped bring attention to his case to the FBI because she made some allegations in her court filings that he had confessed to trading on inside information to her. This was all in her court document. And the FBI was intrigued by that. And they noticed this at a time where they were just starting to investigate SAC. And it really played a role in their interest.
And then there's the new girlfriend who he married, Alex, who comes across almost as a Lady Macbeth type character. And also Cohen's psychiatrist, Ari Kiv, who seems to have encouraged him to become ruthless. Do shrinks usually do that?
Incredibly, many hedge funds employ psychologists and psychiatrists to help coach their traders. And this is part of this mentality that they will do anything that might give them an advantage, an edge over their competitors. So Cohen particularly felt that his traders who were good, who had good instincts and good ideas, he thought that they should be more aggressive with their trades because, if you have a great idea, but you only bet, a tiny amount of your money into it, you're just not going to make as much as you could. So he was, and then, of course, many of the traders were anxious and, you know, I worked at a hedge fund. It's extremely stressful. You know, you have to have the right personality to do that type of work. You're basically being asked on a minute-by-minute basis to make a decision on limited information about risking money that belongs to other people, your investors. And some people are genetically well-suited to that type of work. And Mr. Cohen is one of those people. He could handle risk. It didn't keep him up at night. But a lot of people working for him were not like that, and they would feel really worried about losing a lot of money. So Dr. Keeve was in there, and one of his jobs was to try and push those people to overcome their fears and embrace the idea of being winners and being successful. And he had a background working with Olympians and Olympic athletes and somehow felt that this type of coaching was applicable to traders on Wall Street.
I wonder if I would have had gone further in radio if I'd had him as a shrink.
It's not too late.
But you left the field because you were not ruthless enough to be a hedge fund
trader? I was a very unhappy hedge fund analyst for several years. It was a very interesting experience for me. I felt a bit like an anthropologist, had been dropped into this world. I did not have a background in finance, but it's a long story, but I got out of college and was temping and trying to figure out what to do with my life. And I got sent in to answer phones at a small hedge fund. And the manager of that fund liked me and convinced me to stay and taught me the business. And it was a very interesting few years, but it was not for me. And was much happier once I was making a lot less money as a writer.
Getting back to Stephen Cohen, Preet Bharara winds up coming into the story. He's well known in this area, especially since he's done a number of investigations into insider trading. President Obama nominated him for the U.S. Attorney's Office, the Southern District of New York, with the idea that he would go after these kinds of people?
I don't think that was necessarily the idea. And in fact, this investigation was already going on before Preet took the job. And in fact, he had just started the job as a U.S. attorney in Manhattan when Rajaratnam was arrested. I believe it was just a few weeks. So he got sort of handed this plate of cases. But he definitely was ambitious, and he felt that these cases were a priority. I believe he started in 2009, the fall of 2009, and the financial crisis, if you recall, was raging at that time, and banks were collapsing, and the financial system was being rescued.
And people wanted bankers to go to jail.
People did want bankers to go to jail. Now, these were not quite the bankers who had a role in the financial crisis, and I think that's where there was a bit of confusion. I mean, these hedge fund cases were going on before the financial crisis. They'd been pieced together for years at the SEC. However, suddenly, 2009, we're in the middle of this financial crisis, and we have this whole docket of hedge fund guys who may end up being charged. It was a very appealing set of cases to pursue. I think Mr. Bharara also believed in them and was concerned about cheating in the industry, so he did decide to devote resources of his office to these cases, and they did end up with an enormous number, I think it was in the 80s, of convictions and guilty pleas. And it's important to note that several of those were reversed later after an appeals court ruling. But he still had, you know, many, many victories to show for it.
But his case against SAC Capital was one of the biggest. The results weren't what we might expect, considering what you've been telling us.
Well, in many respects, this was a story of our time. I mean, a tremendous amount of anticipation built up around this case, and the news media had followed it feverishly because Steve Cohen was such a star on Wall Street, such a powerful figure. It was this incredible moment. The government was going to go after one of the richest men in America, and that's certainly when I became very interested in the story. But over the course of 2013, the government realized that they just did not have the evidence they needed to be sure that they would win in a criminal trial against Mr. Cohen. You know, you could be sure that a defendant like him would have the best lawyers money could buy. You know, there would be no limit on what he could spend on his defense. And they did not want to risk a really humiliating loss. And they felt that they didn't have the goods. They did not have any witness to testify against Mr. Cohen. And they did not have a wiretap that they could play for a jury showing that Mr. Cohen knew that he was trading in inside information. They just did not have the evidence to charge him.
What about his ex-wife, Patricia Cohen, who was suing him? Did she get an additional settlement?
I don't think that her case was resolved to her satisfaction, at least based on my
study. This guy's winning all over the place.
He's very smart. Yeah, he's made the right moves in many moments in his career.
But for a period of time, he was only allowed to trade his family fortune of $10 billion. And Goldman Sachs stood by him throughout his legal troubles. They can trade on his behalf. So how does that work?
Well, so at the end of this sort of dramatic moment when Preet and all his deputies need to decide what to do about Cohen, they realize, okay, we don't have the goods to charge him. We just don't have it. We're going to charge his firm, SAC Capital, instead. This is sort of, they would never quite admit this, but my reading of it was this was their plan B. So they indicted SAC, Steve Cohen's hedge fund. They extracted a settlement from Steve Cohen of almost $2 billion, a remarkable amount of money. And ultimately, Mr. Cohen agreed to shut down his fund. And he agreed to some monitoring for compliance and various other things. But in the end, after paying all that money, he has barely changed his lifestyle. It barely made a dent in his life. He's still enormously wealthy, has over $10 billion. He is allowed to trade that now in his own private family office. And in 2018, just a few months from now, he will be able to start a new hedge fund and manage people's investment money, if he so desires.
And one sad note at the end of your book is just how many of the underpaid federal employees took jobs with big law firms and hedge funds after this.
I was a little shocked by that during my naive time working on this book. However, it is entirely typical and predictable, and many people will look at that and say this is a sign of the revolving door. This is exactly why we're in the pickle we're in economically and politically. You know, the people who are supposed to be policing Wall Street end up working for Wall Street and vice versa. Now, many of them are in Washington directing the economy. But yes, it was a little disheartening to see that. But from the perspective of the government employees, they had put in many years. And in truth, they had made less money during that time than they could have. These were all Ivy League law school graduates, very hardworking. So yes, they got much more lucrative jobs at the end of it.
Sheila Kolhatkar, Sheelahkolhatkar, in case you're looking for the book. Her book is Black Edge, Inside Information, Dirty Money, and the Quest to Bring Down the Most Wanted Man on Wall Street. It is published by Random House. What a pleasure it's been talking with you.
It was lovely to be here. Thank you.